Welcome to another Innovation Forum podcast with me, Ian Welsh. I'm with Gillian Caldwell, CEO of Global Witness, and we're reflecting on the recent Innovation Forum conference on business and human rights in London. Welcome, Gillian.
Thanks very much for having me.
What are your two top areas of concern right now around business performance and human rights, and how are these linking into your work at Global Witness?
Well, I think for Global Witness, there's two top concerns we have. One is the global crackdown on civil society space, by which I mean a growing trend towards restrictions on freedom of speech and freedom of assembly, freedom to register, and the entitlement to receive foreign funds. On the other end of the spectrum, very violent repression that we're seeing in some countries around the world. And the reason I'm connecting this to business and human rights is that there are, unfortunately, countries in which we see businesses and governments collaborating in perpetuating this kind of crackdown, places where businesses themselves are trying to protect their interests and quell, for example, protests where land grabbing is taking place and local communities are in opposition to that or feel that they haven't been allowed the opportunity for free, prior, and informed consent. So this is a global trend. It's extremely concerning, and it's one in which we're really looking for more partnership from and with businesses. And what we see is that while it may appear in some cases that businesses are better off in repressive environments where you could, for example, pay substandard wages, the truth is that in the long run, those kinds of environments are not stable environments in which to build a business and sustain livelihoods. So that's the first trend. I think the second is just the growing expectation of the consumer and the markets themselves that businesses do a thorough job analyzing their supply chains and really engaging in robust due diligence. These are obligations under the OECD guidelines and the guiding principles. And I think the trend is in the right direction, that these regulations are becoming more and more consistent and more pervasive globally. But at the same time, all too often, we're seeing either the failure to complete due diligence as required under international principles or national law, or a sort of a tick box exercise approach to it, where you may outsource your responsibility, which means you really don't have a handle on the supply chains. And in fact, your subcontractor, may even have a financial interest in giving you good news. Or companies are just de-risking, moving out of environments where they worry they may face threats rather than engaging constructively. So once again, closing civil society space and a sort of a rocky path to a robust approach to due diligence.
No, thank you very much. So what sort of parts of the world are we talking about around your first answer then? Where are you seeing this repression of civil society and with business and government collaborating?
Well, we do an annual report, for example, on killings of earth and land rights defenders. And unfortunately, last year was the deadliest year in history. Some of the deadliest countries in the world tend to be in Latin America, according to our research, places like Brazil or Honduras. But there's plenty of restrictions emerging elsewhere throughout the former Soviet Union. And even in Western European countries and in North America, we're seeing increasing restrictions, for example, on freedom of assembly and or access to resources. India is another place. The Ford Foundation, for example, has been forced to close its office in India. So I think there's really very few places in the world that are entirely immune.
I mean, do you think that civil society's expectations are changing around business and human rights obligations then? They're being repressed. There are still lots to do. What are their expectations? Are they improving or are they looking for a better future?
Yeah, I think that, in general, we've seen an evolution. I mean, there was the emergence of so-called corporate social responsibility, which was a trend that started inside the communications divisions of most businesses. And now this has moved to sort of a C-suite concern with substantial financial implications for the bottom line. So that's a trend in the right direction where businesses recognize they can do well by doing good. But on the other hand, we still have a long way to go because I think there's an increasing expectation in the world today of a degree of transparency, for example, in terms of how businesses operate, that's unprecedented. We are pushing hard to end, for example, the existence of anonymous companies or shell companies And that's important to business because you need to know who you're doing business with. And if you're doing business with a company whose ownership is unclear, you may well be engaged with criminals who are laundering money, for example. So I think that there's an important trend towards increased visibility, increased reporting expectations and requirements, and a much more proactive expectation that businesses are in communication with the markets and with their consumers.
How do you link the revelations in the Paradise Papers to business and human rights? A lot of stuff on your website recently about the revelations, but how do you link them directly to human rights?
ICIJ's latest release in the Paradise Papers is, of course, another amazing body of work. And what it reveals is that individuals and governments and businesses are engaged with anonymous companies around the world. And those may be engaged in any number of activities. They aren't necessarily, but those individuals and businesses may, for example, be engaged in tax evasion or tax avoidance, which has significant repercussions for national treasuries and for government's ability to deliver on fundamental human rights obligations. And they may also be vehicles for laundering ill-gotten gains, whether it's driving terrorist enterprises, drug money, or swindling national treasuries of wealth generated by their natural resources.
It's just kind of shocking that it takes this sort of release to really shine the light on what's been going on.
It is shocking, but this is the world in which we live. And I mean, the upside is that businesses now recognize that a single tweet can have substantial market implications. So there's a degree of sensitivity and a degree of vulnerability, which unfortunately seems to be what's required to instigate action in all too many instances.
In the conference session that we spoke in last week, you mentioned the leverage that you're finding the insurance industry can now play, given that they won't provide cover for businesses operating in unstable environments where human rights are typically violated. What's the most effective route to engaging the insurance sector now?
That's a good question, and it's something we're just beginning to explore. We had somebody come in who works specifically as an assessor, as an analyst inside one of the biggest insurers providing insurance risk. And we were really struck by the degree of overlap between the kinds of research she does in the insurance risk industry and the kinds of research we do at Global Witness every day. So we've begun the process of really mapping the insurance industry more broadly. And I think the first step is going to be, since our interests are overlapping, to establish the right players in the industry and to build the relationships and rapport that would enable us to have a steady pipeline of information that can inform the kinds of decisions that we're talking about. We're not looking at a remunerated relationship because that would, of course, jeopardize our independence and our credibility. But I don't think it's going to be difficult, in fact, to get access to these insurers if we have the capacity to provide them information, because it's free information and it's information they want and need in order to make the right decisions.
And is it information that they currently have not been considering?
Well, in some cases it is. I mean, once we've established a network of relationships, you can imagine situations in which we get phone calls and people say, look, we're considering moving into Nigeria. There's an oil block off the coast. These are the players. You know, what could you tell us? Or what sorts of questions ought we to be asking? And what concerns might you have?
Thinking about the insurance sector, is it part of a wider focus for groups such as Global Witness, do you think, to continually to use the business case, the potential for companies being hit on their balance sheet if they choose to ignore human rights risks? Is that a trend you're seeing?
Yeah, I mean, I think the way I think about it is that when you're trying to leverage change in the world, you have three primary avenues. There's people, there's policy, and there's the purse. So people are obviously the voice of individuals, whether it's at the ballot box or expressed through consumer behavior or more generally through communication with businesses. There's policy, you know, the regulation at the national, regional, and global level. And then there's the person. That's the way money behaves. So it's not just insurers that are going to be sensitive to these kinds of concerns, it's investors as well. And there are times where we actually brief investors and help inform the decisions they're making about which businesses are safe and worthwhile investments.
So one thing that came up at the conference was talking about the challenges, some unforeseen, around transition to a low-carbon economy. So for you, what are the key issues here, and what do we need to be doing more of to counter them?
What we really need to generate is an extremely fast yet fair transition to a low-carbon economy. Fast because we've really run out of time in the sense that we're already facing catastrophic consequences. But those will only mount and become more and more significant as carbon loading continues at the pace it has been. So fast is of the essence. And secondly, fair is critically important. And by that, I mean that a majority of the Western nations and developing economies have been the ones that have been carbon loading and contributing the most to CO2 emissions around the world. And yet it's the poorest countries, the developing economies, that are getting hit first and worst, whether it's people in Bangladesh who will ultimately face potential flooding of disastrous levels, or people trying to yield crops in Africa in increasingly warm climate. So what we have to be doing is to think about how we enable countries that have not created this problem and yet at the same time have needs and demands for development and access to electricity to continue to evolve, while at the same time ensuring that the economies that have contributed the most take on the lion's share of the burden for addressing the problem. So that's the first few things to think about. Beyond that, when it gets to the fast transition, what we have to do is remove the barriers for renewable energy to thrive. They're already outpacing expectations, whether it's wind or solar, but they're fighting an uphill battle because governments are continuing to offer substantial fossil fuel subsidies and tax breaks to the fossil fuel companies. And then you don't have a level playing field. You're not operating in a free market. You're operating in which fuel sources that aren't economically viable without those kinds of supports are given a leg up. So we have to level the playing field, phase out those fossil fuel subsidies, and invest in the kind of technology and innovation that will continue to propel renewable energy forward.
One of the challenges, of course, is that many of the raw materials involved in the latest renewable energy technology comes from challenging environments where human rights are violated. So that's another problem or another barrier to a fast development of renewable energy and a low-carbon economy. How do you think business can deal with that challenge best?
That's another good point, because you look at lithium, for example, which is necessary for batteries. There's other minerals involved, and those minerals could just as easily be sourced in ways that drive all sorts of violent conflict and human rights abuses. So what we don't want to see is another race to the bottom in terms of how these ingredients to drive the renewable energy economy are sourced. And the other problem, of course, is that as many companies move in to put new solar farms or wind farms or hydropower in, we don't want to see them replicating the same patterns of behavior that the fossil fuel industry has been engaged in. Once again, just forcibly dislocating people from their land, often in collusion with government, polluting the waterways and the land surrounding the activities. We've got to do it differently than we've done it before.
Summing up then, looking forward, there obviously is a lot going on at the moment, but where do you think the next big challenge is going to come from?
Well, I think what's exciting is that we're starting to get the right frameworks in place. The expectations are becoming clearer. They're becoming regulatory. You know, we need to see an increasingly consistent global framework of regulation around these kinds of issues so that all companies are facing the same expectations, and you don't have some fly-by-night operations doing an end run around the existing regulations. We need to see better enforcement of existing regulations and more accountability for the people who fail to meet their obligations. But I think the trend is in the right direction in terms of the expectations and in terms of the growing public concern and the corporate recognition that they can't continue to behave in ways that degrade the environment and human rights abuses. We're still not where we need to go. And the more leadership companies can show, I know very many of your members and constituents are those leaders, the better off we'll all be.
Great. But I think you're right. There's a real lack of enforcement of existing regulation. There's a lot of laws that are in place, and if they were enforced, things would be becoming significantly better. Gillian Caldwell, Global Witness, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much. I look forward to talking again soon.